The next case is number 063320 and 071590. The Securities and Exchange Commission and Philip Stenger against Charles Homa. This is the appeal of Paul Jones, David Pollack, and Caribbean Ventures International, Incorporated. Mr. Goroff.
It may please the Court. I'm David Goroff on behalf of two of the appellants before you. Caribbean Ventures International, Inc., which I'm going to call CVI2, and David Pollack. Mr. Barron will be speaking to the issues as to Mr. Jones. Your Honors, there are three reasons that require reversal for the finding of contempt as to Pollack and discovery sanctions as to CVI2. First, the Court had no personal jurisdiction over either Pollack or CVI2. There was no basis for nationwide service of process here under 4K1D. And there was no basis for nationwide service of process under the securities fraud statutes, as the Warfield and Cleverling cases show.
What about Rule 71 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? When obedience to an order may be lawfully enforced against a person who is not a party, that person is liable to the same process for enforcing obedience to the order as if a party. So Mr. Pollack was a person who was holding assets that the receiver was trying to gather, and he was someone who needed to turn this over. And so it's really a procedure ancillary to the SEC procedure. In the SEC procedure, of course, you agree that there is nationwide service of process in a national context.
As to parties, Your Honor.
That's what I'm saying, the basic procedure. So in the ancillary procedure, which Rule 71 addresses, why isn't the same scope of authority available?
Well, you know, Your Honor makes factual assumptions that Pollack himself was holding assets that were the legitimate
that
scope.
That goes later on to the merits. He would certainly have the opportunity, once served, to say whatever it is he wants to say about the merits. But if we're focusing only on bringing somebody into the court, then it seems to me Rule 71 is saying in these ancillary procedures, the same kinds of rules are available as in the basic procedures. And, of course, Rule 4 recognizes that there could be a federal statute that authorizes service of process, and we all know that there is one in the securities laws.
Right, but the securities laws has been interpreted to not allow service on non-parties, which I think is the answer to Rule 71.
But you can't, in a case about Rule 71, though, it's not like you're... it's a little bit like the case we were just hearing. You know, it's a question of a procedure that is very intimately tied up with the enforcement of the securities case, and you're saying that the securities laws are somehow an exception to Rule 71.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I'm saying that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure have been interpreted so as not to allow the enlargement of jurisdiction beyond that which is set forth by Congress. And the interpretation in the Warfield and the Cleverling cases show that the substantive statute that one could turn to for nationwide service accepts non-parties specifically in the case of securities fraud. So I believe...
But he's not being accused of securities fraud. He's just being told you have to turn over this money that this other person, Mr. Homa...
Well, if you look at the district court, that's true as to what the accusations are. If you look at the district court's findings here, they go on and make determinations that he was a co-conspirator, that he was assisting in money laundering and the like.
It doesn't quite say that. I mean, you say that in your brief a lot, but I think what the district court, when you read it as a whole, is saying is that Mr. Pollack was a person in active concert or participation with the defendants. He received actual notice of the order, the freeze orders.
Well,
bit different from criminal co-conspirator.
I don't know that he says criminal co-conspirator, Your Honor, but he does say that when he lists out the nine reasons he believes there's a nexus to the U.S., that he's an agent for Homa, for example.
Right.
And he does refer to him, you know, aiding and abetting the conspiracy, knowing the terms of the scheme. None of this is true. which is
but
really.
But that's
the,
not a jurisdictional point. That's a merits point.
I agree with that. What I'm saying is, I agree. On the jurisdictional point, my answer, of course, would be Rule 71 hasn't been what the district court relied on. But I think the more substantive answer to it is what I said, that the Warfield, Cleverlink, and all of the authority shows under the securities fraud statutes, you cannot have nationwide service of process when that is the basis. But even assuming the court has jurisdiction here, Your Honor, the key error, the abuse of discretion by the district court below, concerns the substantive finding of contempt by Pollack. And because Pollack is a minority shareholder and has an interest in CVI-2, CVI-2 basically was given no day in court whatsoever. Also, Your Honor, as to CVI-2, there's no showing, there's no fact suggesting it has any assets of HOMA. HOMA had no transactions with it.
You know, as I read the district court's order, maybe this is too simplistic, but it appears to me the district court, when all is said and done, is finding that there is no meaningful distinction between David Pollack, between, you know, and CVI-2 or Limited or Pollack's wife. They really are all one and the same. I guess that's Kelly Pollack, right?
Right.
It seems to me as a factual matter, that's what the district court has found.
And that's where the district court abused its discretion, Your Honor. Your Honor, incredibly, despite the fact that this is the SEC, which had just concluded a lengthy criminal proceeding in the Southern District of New York, the papers from the Southern District of New York were not produced in discovery. And the admissions that are contained in the files of the Southern District were not considered by the district court.
But why did they need to be? If we conceptualize the Ponzi scheme that HOMA was running, the cash for titles, or whatever it was. And then, so now HOMA has a lot of money, and he goes to Pollack and Jones, and for all we know, other people somewhere, but we're not worrying about them, and tries to park the money somewhere. You might not necessarily need all the rest of that stuff. As long as we know that it's HOMA's money, isn't that...
Well,
and they know it's HOMA's money, and they know it's illegally gotten.
Well, they don't know it's illegally gotten. There's absolutely no fact in the record which shows that it's illegally gotten. Every time, look at the receiver's brief, Your Honor. Every time the receiver is citing to an accusation that Pollack knew of the conspiracy, knew that HOMA had done wrong, he cites to the district court opinion. Now, again, in the criminal proceedings, HOMA got an 80% reduction, a downward departure of his sentence because he was a cooperating witness with the U.S. government. At the time he gave a deposition which outlined all of the people who helped him with his conspiracy, including those who were merely relief defendants. And they are set forth in the civil action that is down below before Judge Guzman, and Pollack and CVI-2 are not parties to that case.
Is this a conspiracy on the Ponzi scheme?
That's correct.
Because there's another issue of at least alleged money laundering.
That's right, Your Honor. And Your Honor, the district court, the Southern District of New York, made a finding that the money laundering and securities fraud schemes each ended as of August 1999.
But that's fine. Why would that finding be binding here if, in fact, the receiver is charged by the court with looking around to find out what happened to HOMA's money and happens to find that some of it landed in Bank Carib or wherever?
Well, the receiver is subject, I believe, to collateral estoppel, and the receiver can't have any greater rights than the SEC has. And there was an admission when HOMA was a cooperating witness, he gave two depositions to the receiver, and he said that David Pollack was not part of Cash for Titles and had no knowledge of
but
it.
But you're saying from a deposition as opposed to a judicial finding that there is some form of estoppel. I'm not familiar with that principle.
The judicial finding, Your Honor, is the finding that the conspiracy ended as of August 1999.
The Ponzi scheme ended
then. No, the money laundering ended as well, Your Honor. There were two findings, and there was an amended judgment in 2005,
right,
which made a finding that everything ended except for fraudulent concealment, which is irrelevant here, as of August of 1999. The fraudulent concealment was HOMA's statements individually to a U.S. attorney. It has nothing to do with Pollack, has nothing to do with the bank. HOMA in his deposition, which again, 10 is the basis for his downward departure, says the bank is legitimate. As Your Honor is showing, the court below collapses the bank and HOMA and Pollock as though they are one.
Well, the bank may be perfectly legitimate vis-a-vis, you know, the 119 other investors and whatever money they put into it.
That's
and
right.
Yet the bank, just I can think of all sorts of cases in this area where banks have some money that's being laundered through them and other money that may be perfectly okay. And nobody ever comes to the district court and says, well, of, you know, of the 7 million or 6.2 or whatever it was that you wanted, five of it's from HOMA and the rest of it isn't.
Well, but Your Honor, this is a Dominica bank subject to Dominica, not U.S. law.
And
it is not subordinate
perfectly.
To U.S. law.
I understand Pollock that perfectly. And the bank is never ordered to do anything, as a matter of fact. It is Pollock.
As an
and Jones that are offered to do things, not the bank.
But what Pollock and Jones do, what Pollock does is he helps facilitate a transfer from one bank account in the U.S. to another correspondent bank account in Greece.
I understand
it doesn't
that.
Go to Pollock, Your Honor. He's being held personally liable for funds that remained with the bank. And and if you look at the Union Bank case, Your Honor, at our reply at page 8, the funds in a correspondent bank account are not individuals' accounts. They don't belong to HOMA. They belong to the bank on behalf of all of its depositors. Moreover, the court is angry.
But Pollock was told not to move the money around. Pollock is a U.S. citizen, right?
Pollock at the time was in Dominica.
He wasn't a Dominican citizen, though. He's a U.S. citizen.
He's a U.S. citizen.
Right.
He was in Dominica. He was an officer of the bank. This is the Reebok case, Your Honor.
It's not the Reebok case. The Reebok case is about foreigners.
Well, Your Honor, he has fiduciary obligations as a foreign resident and as an officer of a foreign bank.
But, Mr. Goroff, you know perfectly well that in this whole line of cases about trying to raise foreign law as a defense, courts draw very fine lines. Is it civil liability? Is it criminal liability? Have you exhausted your remedies with the local government? What law is it in the local environment that you supposedly have violated? None of that is in this record.
Well, that's not true, Your Honor. And one thing I also want
it
the court
true.
To... Well, I don't believe that's true, but we can disagree. But if you also, Your Honor, look at the stipulation that the SEC entered into with the bank through counsel that Pollock obtained, they made clear that the asset freeze order is not intended to freeze all of the bank's transfers,
right,
but only HOMA-specific monies. And HOMA-specific monies were not in the Dane Rauscher account that got transferred out. They also, there's nothing that precludes the bank, once it's in Dominica, from following Dominica law, which is set forth in the account agreement for HOMA's account that allows setoffs. If you are an officer of a bank and the bank allows you to take setoffs and you don't take those setoffs, you have breached your duty to the bank. You have breached your duty to the other depositors. And that, Your Honor, is the Reebok case. It is also the Society International case. U.S. law shouldn't be able to put people who are officers of foreign companies acting abroad. He was not in the United States in a position of conflict.
Well,
and that
again,
is what happened
US
here.
U.S. law, well, you're raising a question that's been litigated for a long time, but U.S. courts, once they have personal jurisdiction over somebody, can order them to take actions that will support what the case is before the U.S. court, even if there's a conflict with foreign law.
And, Your Honor, as to CVI...
The Interhandel case is very clear about that. There's some remedies that you might not go far for, but there are plenty of cases that so hold.
As to CVI 2, there's a discovery sanction because its officers will not fly to the U.S. Discovery sanctions under 37B2, as the General Insurance Company case says, only apply to parties. They were not a party. They, as Your Honor is saying, the district court collapsed Kelly Pollock, who is a free individual, the majority shareholder, and an officer of the bank, as though she were her husband. There is no factual basis for that. And the findings as to CVI-2 should be reversed. Your Honor, I see I'm eating into my rebuttal time, and I want to give Mr. Barron time as well.
Thank you, Mr. Goroff. We'll hear now from Mr. Barron.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Barron, and I represent the appellant and non-party respondent Paul Jones in this matter. I'd like to pick up on a point that we were discussing a moment ago concerning the application of the Reebok case. One of the concerns that we fronted in this case very early on with Judge Guzman in the lower court was the complete lack of effort by the SEC or the receiver to serve or register the freeze orders back in 1999 when they were first issued with the authorities in Dominica. And so as a very threshold matter, we asserted, both in the trial court as well as today, that those orders were a nullity and had no binding effect on Bank Carib or its officers and agents.
Well, it's the second part of that sentence that I think we need to focus on, because you're right. I mean, this order was not directly served or in any way, you know, the machinery of Dominica didn't get engaged to do this. Instead, the court chose to give orders directly to the U.S. citizens that were subject to its jurisdiction. Now, there's a lot of literature about whether that's something that the rest of the world likes or doesn't like, or the rest of it. And if you were to try to do that in France, you might find yourself, you know, violating various laws, but as well as other countries. But the fact is that U.S. courts do that. There was, in fact, no effort to tell Dominica what to do with the bank. They didn't tell them to fold it up. They didn't tell them to do anything. They told these people who are U.S. citizens to do things. And that's a line that we've respected for a long time.
Well, I would step back from there, Your Honor, with due respect. The government did none of that. In fact, the orders didn't even come down by the government's efforts at all. They were sent down by a corresponding bank from the United States. But in any event, I think the point I'm trying to...
Well, even more so, then, there was certainly nothing inappropriate going on in Dominica. I mean, I think that undermines your first point. I know what the orders said, and they said, you know, the receiver is supposed to collect the money, including blah, 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 and it happened to mention Bank Carib, but was not in any way, in any offensive way, served on a foreign bank.
Well, I guess the threshold point, though, that I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is what is that foreign bank to do when it receives a freeze order from a foreign jurisdiction? And we assert that Mr. Jones at all times is acting with his hat as a Dominican resident, as an officer, an agent, and bound by the laws of Dominica to otherwise abide by those laws. And one other point of clarification I wanted to make is that it appears in our record, because we submitted a declaration of Kevin Williams, that there are certain rules and regulations that are required before an order ever gets even to the level of enforceability on the island. And those
but
are set forth clearly.
The district court did not place a great deal of weight on Mr. Williams, who's, I gather, kind of an interested party here. The district court didn't place too much weight on that.
I don't think the district court, Your Honor, addressed it at all. And irrespective of Mr. Williams' interest or non-interest, the receivership put in no evidence at all of any countervailing law in Dominica that says, oh, you know, when you get a freeze order from the United States District Court, you automatically have to comply with it.
No, you don't need to do that. I mean, you keep jumping as though this went to the bank, and it went to these U.S. citizens. And sometimes people do face conflicting legal obligations. You know, if the bank in Dominica told Mr. Jones to send a large amount of money to Cuba, Mr. Jones, as a U.S. citizen, would similarly be facing a conflicting legal obligation, since there are obligations on U.S. citizens about trade with Cuba. You litigate that when that happens. You don't just start moving things around. You don't automatically, as a U.S. citizen, assume that the foreign law prevails. There's a conflict of laws.
Well, I think from our standpoint, we put in evidence of what that conflict was. We put in evidence that the orders had no effect on the island of Dominica, much like the Reebok case.
But people lose these cases all the time. You know the line of cases, the Bank of Nova Scotia cases, the First National City Bank cases. There are many cases that deal with similar kinds of conflicts, and U.S. courts in these prior cases typically will say you have the, you know, this duty to exhaust. The duty lay, in fact, on people like Mr. Jones to go to the authorities in Dominica and say, I'm here between a rock and a hard place. Will you give me a waiver? Will you do this? The duty wasn't on the receiver or others. The U.S. court was issuing its own orders.
Well, I think we place our authority in the Reebok case, which seems to suggest, and in fact, as I recall in that case, Reebok went even further than the receiver here and actually tried to domesticate the judgment in Luxembourg and failed to do that. And the Ninth Circuit in Reebok said, look, you know, as a threshold matter, that order was a nullity as against the Bank of Luxembourg. And that's our position here, Your Honor, which is that those orders were a nullity as against Bank Carib and its officers and agents. Moving on, if I may, Your Honor, the other merits issues in the case have to do with whether or not Mr. Jones should have ultimately been found to be in contempt for the acts at issue in the case. And those, of course, were two acts. One was the transfer, interbank transfer of certain funds from a corresponding bank in the U.S. to a corresponding bank in Greece. As a threshold point, Your Honor, the money never left the bank. We argue, as the court is aware, that the orders themselves were not clear and equivocal, as evidenced by the very fact that they had to be amended once, and ultimately, later on, a stipulation was entered where the government acknowledged that there was an unintended side effect to those orders, which is that they froze not just the assets of Mr. Homa, but the entire asset base of the bank. And so the orders were not clear and unequivocal as required under the law. In addition, Your Honor, there's a question of timing here. And I think it's undisputed that the SEC never sent the orders directly to Bank Carib or to Mr. Jones or Mr. Pollack. They learned of the fact of something going on in the United States early on the morning of October 18th. At that point in time, they were doing whatever they needed to do to try to keep the bank alive. They weren't aware of the terms of the order. They weren't aware of the scope of the order. They just began calling their corresponding banks, which they did. They found Payne Weber did not have a hold on its accounts, and so they took actions and efforts in advance of ever receiving a copy of the freeze order to protect the assets of the bank.
Now I was just looking. The receiver's brief mentions on page 28 that the money that went to Alpha Bank in Greece ultimately was not included in the $7.2 million that the court ordered anyway to avoid double counting. So why are we worrying about that money?
Well, the court, what I'm saying is that's the first of the two contemptuous acts, which gave the court apparently its hook to hold Mr. Jones in contempt. And I want to be clear that there were errors, factual errors, that led the court to an erroneous conclusion on that point. But moving forward, Judge, to the second point of contention, the second contemptuous act, that had to do with the initial alleged ownership of Mr. Homa in the bank. The receiver initially pled a claim that said he owned at least half of the bank. Later on, he amended his claim to suggest, well, if he didn't own half or all of the bank, he had some sort of unvested interest in the bank.
Didn't the district court find this was just a complete mess? I mean, people had signed these promissory notes. The notes were unclear. It was unclear who was owning what. It was unclear whether stock was going to be issued. It was unclear whether there were oral agreements. I thought the district court thought that this whole thing was...
I think that's
a
fair characterization of Judge Guzman's order, and I think that underscores the point, Your Honor, that there was no clear and convincing evidence in this case. In fact, they never bothered.
So if you mess it up enough, you know, you can get away with moving this money. I mean, there's a problem here, isn't there, from a policy standpoint?
What I'm suggesting is the receiver had every right in his power and control to bring Mr. Homa into court, to put him on the stand and testify. He was long out of prison at the time of the hearing last year. They didn't bother to do that. They are left with a record as what it is, which is that there was a deal that was made by Mr. Homa and the bank. Mr. Homa may not like the deal, but ultimately that's a contract issue, Your Honor. And in fact, the receiver attempted to bring a contract action against Caribbean Ventures for the cancellation of those notes and then later dropped it. So that's the real relief here, is to pursue a contract action. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. We'll hear now from Mr. Van Essen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Doug Van Essen on behalf of the receiver, Philip Stenger. It's undisputed in this case that on Friday, October 15, 1999, Charles Richard Homa was chairman of the board of Bank Carib. He also had on deposit in the bank $5.8 million of money that he illegally garnered from C4T investors.
Now, when you say it's undisputed, are you meaning that it's undisputed that that money came from the C4T venture, or are you saying it's undisputed that Mr. Pollack and Mr. Jones knew that the money that Mr. Homa had put in the bank was illegally acquired?
I'm saying that it's irrelevant whether Mr. Pollack and Mr. Jones knew that this money had come from a securities fraud. Whether, in fact, it even came from the securities fraud was irrelevant. The fact that it's Homa's money and it's sitting in their bank is what is relevant for the contempt paradigm, because the freeze order...
Because it's all about restitution, right?
Absolutely. The freeze order applies to Mr. Homa and to all of his assets. Now, these assets...
Even if his granduncle had given him $500 million?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Now, we know that that money was C4T money. We also know that $3 million, as of October 15, 1999, of C4T funds had been invested by Mr. Homa in the bank as its only source of capital.
What about these other investors, though? These are depositors? Who are these other people, these 119 or...
I have
so
no idea,
people.
Your Honor, because they've hid behind Dominican bank secrecy laws. I suspect that they're either Pollack and Jones themselves or affiliates, or they may even be affiliates of Mr. Homa. We simply don't know. And it really isn't that relevant for, I think, the contempt paradigm. What is relevant is that on October 15th, Mr. Homa, as chairman of the board of the bank, was served with a copy of the freeze order, and it's admitted by Mr. Pollack and Mr. Jones that they received actual notice of the freeze order, both orally by Dean Rauscher on Monday morning, as well as by fax later on that day. And thereafter, after they admit they had possession of those freeze orders, they took $5.8 million out of Mr. Homa's account. They also, after they knew about the freeze orders, admit that they then canceled his investment interests in Bank Carib. So after they had the freeze orders in their possession, they liquidated his depository interests, they liquidated his investment interests in the bank.
Why was there no effort, though, made to get some sort of interim relief from the courts of Dominica? Surely they don't want to be parties to frauds in banks. They're trying to make banking a business.
It doesn't matter.
One could
matter.
Have filed something, I would assume, in those courts, just to preserve the status quo as of October 15th in the bank.
One of the errors that is laden in the appellant's argument is the notion that injunctions and asset freezes are territorial. They're not. They're personal. They apply to, and in our supplemental authority, we cite the First National Bank case.
You don't want to overstate that because, if the person is within the personal jurisdiction of the court and the court otherwise has legitimate jurisdiction over that person, such as perhaps with a U.S. citizen, it's the position of the U.S. courts that that person has to comply with an injunction. But you're not saying, the U.S. courts recognize Mariva injunctions, for example, sending an injunction out across the rest of the world. There are territorial aspects of injunctions.
Let's say that I had been Richard Homa's attorney on October 15, 1999. I practice out of Michigan, and I traveled to Dominica, and on behalf of Mr. Homa, asked for that $5.8 million. Would I not be violating this district court's injunction as a
sure,
United
because
States
the court
citizen?
Has jurisdiction because the court has jurisdiction over you
absolutely.
As a person.
Absolutely.
You would be.
And it would have jurisdiction over me, we maintain, primarily because of the Securities Act and the nationwide jurisdiction.
In your hypothetical, what kind of notice would you have expected to receive?
Well, in this case, there was the service of the bank by the SEC. There was also the fax copy.
Service of Mr. Homa, you mean,
service
as
of
chairman
Mr.
of the bank. Yeah.
Right. And all that is necessary under the ex parte Lennon case decided by the Supreme Court is actual notice. So if I have actual notice, it's really irrelevant whether I was served by the SEC or the government officials, faxed by my client. It doesn't really matter. I have notice. I cannot go to Dominica as an agent or someone acting in concert with Mr. Homa and take that money. And if I do, I'm subject to contempt proceedings in the district court, wherever it's located, for that violation, regardless of whether the court, the state in which that court is located, has personal jurisdiction over me under its long-arm statute.
Mr. Van Essen, this is a really probably trivial question, but how in the world did this case end up in Illinois? I mean, it was in the Southern District of New York. We know that a fair amount of things happened in Florida, and here it is in Illinois. And so, and you're from Detroit, you know, from Michigan. And
yes, it's my understanding, and I wasn't involved at that in time, Your Honor, that there were investors throughout the United States. So the nexus between the C4T Ponzi scheme in New York was no different than the nexus in Chicago. And frankly, my understanding of why it was transferred over here was that the civil lawyers from the SEC that were handling the case were out of Chicago.
Okay.
So it was transferred here for that purpose.
That would make sense.
There are multiple errors that I think are inherent in the appellant's position on personal jurisdiction, which, frankly, I think the record, as I've articulated here today, is so clear on the contempt that the only two issues that I think are worthy of the court's energy are whether or not Mr. Pollack and Mr. Jones can get away with their brazen behavior, because they clearly violated the court's orders, using the personal jurisdiction defense. And the other issue is whether Mr. Pollack should have the benefits of this court's activities when it is so clear that, as Judge Posner would put it, he's presenting a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose proposition with respect to the enforcement of the court's order. Those, I maintain, are really the issues that make this case interesting and of potential value to the precedent of the federal courts. And as I've said, there are multiple errors that I think are inherent in the appellant's position on personal jurisdiction. One is this concept that injunctions are territorial, not personal.
By which you mean an injunction that properly has reached somebody in the United States can be evaded as soon as they hop on an airplane and go to another country.
Exactly. Or in my analogy, I travel down to Dominica even though I'm an attorney in Michigan subject to the jurisdiction of the court, and I then try to appropriate mm-hmm. those funds. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and Judge Wood, you've already put your finger on this, whether or not Pollack and Jones were involved in the securities scam, whether or not, Judge Mannion, they were even involved in the money laundering, which Mr. Homa was so obviously engaged in through the Bank of Dominique, is really irrelevant. What is critical is that they were agents and in active concert with Mr. Homa on October 15, 1999. That's what subjected them to the jurisdiction of the United States District Court.
So just to be clear that I understand you, you are rejecting the notion that this is any kind of extension of money laundering. This is all about the effort of the government to collect money that belongs to Mr. Homa so that that money then can be used for restitution for the victims of the Ponzi scheme.
Absolutely. It may go to the intensity of their association or their concert with him. But even if it was a legitimate bank, legitimate deposits, even deposits unassociated with the scam, and there's a business interest there that may have been entirely legitimate, it wouldn't change the contempt paradigm at all. You cannot take those deposits. You cannot cancel that business interest. Another error.
And the other thing is, I guess, this property in Florida, right? The lease.
Absolutely.
They paid, yeah.
Many of the creditors, many of the parties, non-parties who receive these freeze orders may have very legitimate claims to the money ultimately that presumably they'll be allowed to resolve in the district court when it's liquidating the assets. So they claim that they were entitled to accelerate these lease payments and then take the money. And they also sold the house, by the way, a house that was bought by Mr. Homa with C4T funds. So they really triple-dipped on that particular transaction. But the relevant thing is they had no business engaging in self-help by withdrawing that money out of his account.
So what they should have done is, as part of your marshalling efforts, they should have just put it all in front of the district court and let the court figure out who owned what, even though it was, it could have been, I suppose, a ranch in Argentina, or it could have been, it doesn't matter where it was located.
That's correct, Your Honor. And all they had to do, and this is another error they make, they have no room in their analysis for the very limited nature of the personal jurisdiction that's being asserted here. They maintain that the only non-parties who are subject to Securities Act freeze orders are not parties subject to the long-arm statute general jurisdiction of the state in which the court sits. That's not the kind of jurisdiction we're attempting to assert. It's very specific and very limited. All they had to do was not take. They simply had to freeze those assets. They also ignore the fact that contempt is akin to tortious behavior. You can't hide behind the corporate shield. It would not be a defense to me if I, sitting in Grand Rapids with Mr. Homa's retainer, took it to Windsor and spent it, that I might have been acting on behalf of my law firm and not me individually. Contempt is personal. Contempt is akin to a tort. It's akin to criminal behavior. You can't hide behind the corporate shield. And it's absolutely irrelevant whether or not they benefited from their misappropriation and their violation, or whether Bank Carib did. They violated it. They injured the receivership. They're subject then to disgorgement and to restitution, subject, of course, to their ability, as Mr. Pollock or Jones has been released from prison because he was able to prove at a point in time where he was unable to pay further than he had done. There's also no compulsion defense here. And they suggest that they took the money because Dominican law required them to take the money. They hadn't taken the money before Mr. Homa was arrested. It's not like Mr. Homa showed up in Dominica and asked for his $5.8 million, which might have at least placed them in the position of the conflict of laws of Dominica, which they want to hide behind it. But that didn't happen here.
If it was his deposit, they had a debt to him. I mean, that's essentially what a deposit is. The bank has the money, but it has a debt to the account party.
That's correct.
So you're saying they were supposed to disregard that legal relationship?
Not at all. Not at all. What I'm saying is they had a responsibility to freeze. They had a responsibility to refrain from taking. And there's not a single Dominican statute that they've cited that, as a positive law, mandated that they take that money.
mandate that, okay, and so you're saying that unless Dominica law said you have to take it, it wouldn't have violated Dominica law just to keep the account there untouched.
Exactly. And in fact, they claim to have frozen it to everyone in the world except themselves. Mm-hmm. And they've never been able to demonstrate that Dominican law required them to take the money. The letter that they wanted to introduce from the Dominican attorney simply related to another situation where apparently a depositor had shown up and demanded the money. And they wanted to prove that in that situation, which is more analogous to the Reebok situation, they then had compulsion, they had to release it. And that may or may not have provided a defense to these U.S. citizens. I don't think the court has to get into that because they never really presented a compulsion defense, and there's not been none presented to here. There's never been any proof that they were compelled to take that money for their own benefit. The other thing that I would like to focus on that I think is an error is this notion that they had to have actual notice.
Let me just back up for a minute, because if I'm understanding them correctly, they are saying, I think, that when they learned about the freeze order, they perceived a threat to Mr. Homa's money as long as it sat there in Bank Carib in Dominica, which is why they were eager to get something moved to another country, in this instance Greece, to Bank Alpha. And so they were, in effect, preserving their preserving his interests by making this move.
Well, they certainly did preserve his interests when they took the money out of his account and zeroed it out, which is really the focus of the court's contempt finding as it relates to relief. I believe that what they were doing with that $2 million was trying to rush it out, because they admitted on the stand that they hadn't done any analysis as to whether the other 119 people were having their liquidity potentially compromised. They never did that analysis. They wanted to get that money overseas so that they could, as opportunists, take it, which is what they did. So if they had moved the money from Payne Weber to Alpha Bank and then had presented Mr. Stenger with the deposit of Mr. Homa and said, well, here it is, it's protected, its liquidity is established, here's the $5.8 million, they may have had, I doubt that this court would have held them in contempt, probably would have verbally chastised them for moving that money from New York, where it would just have been just as secure in Payne Weber, to Alpha Bank, where it was obviously less secure, to the federal courts, but nevertheless have said there's no damage to the receivership because you presented the deposit. That's not what they did here. They took the money out of his account for their benefit and for Bank Reeves. Whether they got service from the SEC, Judge Ripple, I think is absolutely irrelevant, because they knew of the freeze order. The task that faced the SEC in this case, which I'm sure the court appreciates the enormity of it, I mean, this was one of the largest frauds in U.S. history. And there were affiliates literally all over the world and over the United States. The SEC couldn't possibly have served all of those parties. They did serve, they knew about Bank Carib. That's why Bank Carib pops up expressly in the freeze orders. And they did serve Mr. Homa as chairman of the board of Bank Carib as well. And we know from their own admissions, and this is why I didn't need to call Mr. Homa to testify. And by the way, they had authorization from the district court to take his deposition. They chose not to exercise that right that the district court gave them. They had every right to call Mr. Homa as a witness if they wanted to. I didn't need to call Mr. Homa because I had their admissions that we had $5.8 million on deposit, that we had taken his $3 million, that it was the only capital that was involved in the investment in the operation of the bank, that we had copies of the freeze orders from Dane Rauscher on Monday, October 17th, in our hands, and that we thereafter extinguished that interest in the investment of the bank, and we thereafter took the money out of his accounts. Why did I need Mr. Homa?
How important is the Dane Rauscher involvement to your theory? Because sometimes, as you've been talking, I've been thinking that you think that Pollack and Jones are already effectively notified as soon as Homa, in his capacity as chairman of the board of the bank, is notified, that that's, in a sense, also a notification of other officers or leaders of the bank. And sometimes, as you've been standing there, you seem to be stressing more the Dane Rauscher involvement, where, you know, the notifications come through and the facts comes through and the like.
Well, again, because the contempt is personal, it's also corporate from Bank Reeb.
But are you thinking that there's sort of constructive notice to them as soon as Homa knows, or are you willing to say, no, we have to find some basis of actual notice in this record to
the
them?
The latter, for Pollack and Jones individually.
Okay.
I think Bank Reeb was constructively notified, so Bank Reeb might have been held liable for contempt, even if Pollack and Jones didn't know about it and they had manipulated Bank Reeb to violate the order. But we don't have to go there in this instance, because Pollack and Jones admitted under oath that they knew about the freeze order because they got a call from Dane Rauscher, then Dane Rauscher faxed the freeze order. And that is critical to their own individual culpability for the actions that they took thereafter in extinguishing these interests. I want to make it clear to the court before I retreat that we are asking the court to find that the Securities Act itself and the nationwide service there provides the basis for the personal jurisdiction of the court. We find no difference in the status of Pollack and Jones from relief or nominal defendants. Many of them are brought into a securities case because they are holding the fruits of the fraud. They may not have directly violated the act itself, but they're holding the fruits of the fraud, and they can come into the case jurisdictionally for that very limited purpose of disgorging the assets that belong to the SEC defendant that they are holding. And that same nationwide service provides the basis for the court's inherent power and the ancillary jurisdiction to enforce the order, because they're violating the injunction that's expressly authorized under the Securities Act. So we don't think the court has to resort to the long-arm statute of, and one of the problems in these security cases, and this case illustrates it, is which state's long-arm jurisdiction statute would you use? New York, where the orders were issued, or Illinois, where the case was subsequently transferred. But if you disagree with me on this point in the receiver, there is also jurisdiction, and that's the Waffen-Schmidt case, where you could premise the jurisdiction of the court using the long-arm statute of Illinois, because it, as we know, and I cited in our supplemental authority, that's as extensive as the federal due process standards. And Waffen-Schmidt finds, similarly to the first case that the court had before it, that by being in active concert, and clearly these were intimate agents and concerters, if you will, with Homa, and then learning of the freeze order, and then knowingly violating that freeze order, you are placing yourself within the jurisdiction of the court that issued that order. That has to be the rule. This court cannot accept their view of the corporate shield and the requirement for general jurisdiction using the long-arm statute of the state in which the district court sits, as limitations on the ability of a federal court to enforce these freeze orders, or you're going to dramatically limit their effect. The only parties in their view that would be subject to the enforceability of this asset freeze would be those entities and individuals who are subject to the general jurisdiction of the Illinois state courts. That can't be the rule of law this court will accept. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Essen. Mr. Roth has 3 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honor, the version of the facts that Mr. Van Essen portrays to you are entirely at odds with what the actual record would show. Again, HOMA admits that Pollack has nothing to do with the cash for title scheme. The asset freeze orders at issue do not go to Pollack personally, nor do they mention Pollack. He's never served with a copy of these by the government.
But one thing Mr. Van Essen said that I think is interesting is once the government in a case reaches the point of trying to collect assets to use for victim restitution, those assets don't have to be traced to the wrongdoing. It's a general obligation on the part of the person. So in other words, Mr. HOMA, as I was trying to explore, might have monies that were legitimately collected, might have others that weren't. Mr. Van Essen says, so what? As long as you know it's his money, that's all you need.
Precisely. Let me respond to that, Your Honor. $3.5 million was sent by the bank to the SEC. That was net of the set-offs that the bank took, which are, it's undisputed, are permitted under Dominica law. Now, there was no freeze in Dominica. And Henry Dyer, the Attorney General of Dominica, said that in order to enforce a freeze order in Dominica, you would have had to domesticate it first. There is no reason for Pollack, as an officer of a Dominica corporation, to assume that the freeze orders in the U.S. were to have any extraterritorial application in Dominica. HOMA is not entitled to just what he deposits. He's entitled under Dominica law to what he deposits, net of what he owes. And these were set-offs. There is no dispute that the bank took set-offs for which the receiver now wants to hold Pollack and Jones personally liable, even though they did not personally benefit from this money. They did not receive it. It remained with the bank. The bank went into liquidation. They could have pursued the bank in liquidation. They chose not to. They made a very minor settlement with the liquidator, and they instead went after these individuals personally for doing what was within their fiduciary duty. The 119 depositors, Your Honor, we don't know who they are. He asks you to assume they're evildoers cloaked beneath secrecy. Assume they're ordinary Dominican citizens. Why did the monies that should exist to protect them and the fiduciary duties that apply to them, why should they be violated by a law that is never domesticated where that takes place? And there is no answer. And again, remember that there is a stipulation in order that allows the bank to do its business as usual. It's R-1537, and it's been totally ignored by the court. The SEC makes a stipulation saying it is only HOMA's specific money in the U.S. that we're concerned with, and then tries to hold these individuals liable when that only turns up so much money. This is not the case of Cuba, Your Honor. Cuba, there is a statute where everyone knows what U.S. citizens can do is to Cuba. You're not to assume as a U.S. citizen that a freeze order, which ought to be domesticated in order to be enforceable in the country in which you sit, in which you hold office, applies when it hasn't been so. And that's what's happening here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Goroff. We'll hear now from Mr. Barron.
Thank you. Just to tail on one point concerning the set-offs before we leave that topic, we raised in our briefs, and I want to underscore here that the issue of the set-offs was never pled in either of the motions for rule to show cause, was never raised at any time until the actual hearing. So one of the points we make as a threshold is that that should have never been presented in the contempt proceeding to begin with. I adopt the other arguments of Mr. Goroff on that point. I also want to come back, Judge Wood, to a point that or an example that you made, I think, during the argument of Mr. Van Essen. This is not the case of Mr. Jones hopping on a plane and flying down to Dominica, walking into Bank Harib, knocking on the door, and withdrawing money inappropriately after getting notice of a freeze order. A year and a half before this ever happened, Mr. Jones gave up his life in the United States, moved down to Dominica, was living there, was a resident there, was operating a bank there, and was subject to the laws of Dominica there. And so I think that's an important point that I keep hammering upon, but I think it's one that I urge the panel to consider in deliberations, that we're talking about freeze orders that have an impact in foreign countries on foreign institutions, albeit run by United States citizens. I think that we have to be very careful about how far we go in enforcing such orders unless they are domesticated properly under the law of that nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Our thanks to all counsel in the case, and this case will now be taken under advisement.